things I want to talk about today, sort of a tangled creative process that led me to this. I want to talk a little bit about Paul, and then finally address some questions that more or less continuously are raised within me about God and how we talk about God and the language we use about God and our understanding of God. First thing, this story of Paul, this story of Paul's conversion in Galatians, and just as a fairly minor point, it's pretty interesting to compare Luke's storytelling with Paul's account of his conversion. Paul speaks very sparely about what happened to him. God pleased to reveal his son to me, and that changed my life. The author of the book of Acts, by comparison, tells a very and much more famous story, the road to Damascus, the blinding light, the voice of Jesus saying, "Why are you persecuting me?" All of that is an embellishment, I think, by Luke. He's a storyteller, and we see that today. Had we read a little more of this lesson from 1 Kings, we would have heard Elijah healing the widows, bringing the widow's son back to death. And Luke is positioning Jesus as at least as great and maybe even greater than Elijah. A great prophet has risen among us. So Luke's a storyteller. The thing I want to focus on in Paul is really a very simple thing. He let his mind be changed. He let his mind be changed, which to us may sound like the most common thing in the world, and actually it might be one of the rarest. Look back over your life and see if there are times when you, in some fundamental way, came to see something in a new way. I had been seeing this one way, and now I see it differently. You might, you know, a person might fall under that, or a political position, or an attitude, but often the opposite is more true of us. We live in habitual worlds and habitual ways of seeing things. And we usually talk about that tendency of ours more in Lent. But actually, it's one of the most crucial spiritual issues for us, that we not see the world in merely habitual terms. And again, when we do see the world in habitual terms, when we approach a situation that we think we know what's going to happen, we have prejudged that situation. We are living out of a place of prejudice. And of course, prejudice is pervasive. Prejudice doesn't mean I don't like people of a different religion or I don't like people of a different skin color. Prejudice also means when you sit down with your spouse at breakfast and you think you know what he or she is going to say or do, and so you're not really expectantly looking for what might emerge from that other person or from yourself. So it's just kind of running on habit. And the opposite of this within the Christian world is repentance, the repenting mind, that we allow our minds to be changed. And I don't know if you've noticed in the way I've been speaking a blessing, I've been talking about may we let God change us. And we don't always. I mean, we remember some of the notable changes, like John Newton, the slave ship captain, who had been treating these human beings as pieces of lumber. And something within him woke up. Something within him woke up so that he began to see that these other beings were in fact other human beings. And it completely changed his life. But I think we need to remember that it need not have changed his life. I think he could have refused that. And he could have refused it because it's really upsetting to change fundamentally the way you see things. You know, imagine John Newton. I'm a slave ship captain. That's my identity. And if something then occurs to him that says, you can't be a slave ship captain anymore. He might accept that new way of seeing things, or he might say, I can't go through that kind of a change. And then he would be in that position of playing out the teaching of Jesus. If you would save your life, you'll lose it. If you save your identity as a slave ship captain, resisting that invitation to see things in a new, larger, more truthful way, you'll keep that safe identity and you'll keep making money on your slave ship, and you'll lose that opportunity to enter into and participate in a much fuller reality. Letting our minds be changed is not an insignificant event. And I think it also has to do with this flexibility of mind, this repenting mind. The way I've sort of thought of it is, I want my life to proceed at the same pace that God moves. What is the pace at which God moves? And it's a funny thing because it involves us both in time, all of us creatures of time. Look at your body. Notice. Changing. And entropically, not exactly for the better. Some of you still on that upward, that ascending curve, but many of us, as they say, we have begun our descent. I hate to say it, but letting our minds be not so much changed as open requires us to be in the present moment. I mean, really. And again, I would just draw our attention to that common wisdom, how much time we spend not in pace with God. We are racing ahead, trying to anticipate what's going to happen and trying to control that. It hasn't even happened yet. You don't really know what you're going to face when you get to that moment. Or we get stuck in the past where we're thinking so hard about something that's already happened and we can't undo it, but we can't let go of it, or we can't deal with the consequences. And so with the familiar snags both ahead of us and behind, how interesting and often difficult it is to practice the discipline of being in the present moment. And, you know, as Jesus said, let the day's troubles be enough for itself. You know, every day will bring enough trouble. Deal with today. Kind of the pace of God, which I think is it's inseparable from being open-minded, receptive to the newness of every moment and responsive to that. That, I think, is our spiritual ideal. Not to run too far ahead, not to get caught in the past. Responsive to what the actual moment brings us and deal with that. Okay, so that's what I was thinking about Paul and his change of mind. The rest, you know, we've got these two stories of sons being raised to life. And I can't really trace the train of thought that brought me to the issue of God. And I you know, for some time now, I've realized that I almost always, at least in my mind, put the word God in quotes when I say it. Because at almost every point, I'm aware, at least, that if there are 50 people in the room, there are probably 50 different meanings of that word God. And that so much of what we do, everything about Jesus, all of what we do, really depends on some working understanding of God, the source of all of this. And our language about God is troubled. It's in process of changing. And, you know, Marcus Borg, I think, has been pretty helpful, at least to me, about that. And the comparison that he makes is really one of the old models for talking about God was called supernatural theism. It's like there is a God out there. And surprisingly, God thinks and acts and makes decisions quite a bit like us. Yeah, you know, I made that remark. It was an offhand remark a couple weeks ago about how every spider prays to a God with eight legs. And people started repeating that to me. And all I really wanted to say is how ingrained our tendency is to think of God as a being like us, and how crucial it is to realize that that is entirely false. That God's ways are not our ways. God's thoughts are not our thoughts. We're not talking about a being out there separate from us to whom we make, you know, our pleas, our prayers. And then, of course, the well-documented problem with the thought that God is a being out there who is going to act. God, please, save my son. Okay. But what about, I mean, that's called intervening. I will save that son. But what about the millions and millions and millions of events where God does not intervene? The interventionist model of God breaks down where God does not intervene. It's not a consistent picture that we can get of God. And where I would always like to return us is to what I think is a more deeply Hebrew sense of God, which is Moses and the burning bush. Who shall I say sent me? I am who I am. So that God is not a being, but God is being itself. And I think, I mean, I know I struggle a lot trying to find language for God in terms of the world that we actually inhabit. You know, a world where the universe is measured in light years, and we have some sense of the scale of time and space. I want a God who is a God that calls that universe into being. And we need to understand that that's not a creature like us. And yet how desperately we need a sense that we're not alone here. I mean, that we are alone is one of the central affirmations, I would say, of the 20th century. You know, you read somebody like Bertrand Russell, and he says, get over it, you bunch of whining children. Can't you figure it out that we're alone here on this insignificant piece of gravel? There's no meaning to the universe. There's no source. It's all just a random mechanistic accident. And there is nothing in my heart that believes that at all. Not a bit. But I also don't think there's an old man with a beard out there somewhere just, you know, at the light board kind of trying to keep up with all the changes. That's not work for me. And I think one of the most crucial ways that I need to feel that we're not alone is in facing the really significant problems that we face as human beings. I mean, I heard some guy say, I was born in the 60s and there were not quite 3 billion people, and now there are 7 billion people in that space of 50 years. And, you know, issues of climate and issues of violence. And I take great comfort in the thought that in every human being on the planet, God's presence is at work. It may be completely ignored, and it may be completely misunderstood, but that for every human being on the planet, there is a moment when that inner presence might finally make itself heard, and it might be listened to, and the world will begin to look different. And we're not alone. In the heart of all human beings, there is a spiritual presence that we refer to by that troublesome word, God. There is a presence, and that presence inclines us to do the right thing, inclines us to see ourselves as beloved, inclines us to see the value of other creatures. And the world will change only when we listen to that presence. Everything else is putting our faith in children of earth. Everything else. And of that hunger for the true God, one of the tests that I sometimes repeat to myself is, if I think God is on my side, I am almost certainly wrong. God does not take sides in that partisan human way. I mean, we've talked and laughed about two teams praying to God, make me win. God doesn't take sides like that. And it's not God being on my side. That's taking God's name in vain. History, lots of examples, all bad. The possibility that is put before us is that not that we get to, that God will work on my side, but that I get to work on God's side. And it really has to do with, what is God doing? This God whose name the Hebrew people wouldn't even pronounce. The God who is beyond our human language and beyond our human understanding, and yet has spoken and has been revealed to us in the person of Jesus and in many other men and women throughout time. What is that God doing? And can we celebrate the transcendent joy of being invited to share in that and participate in that, to be collaborators with the creator of the universe? If we think we are insignificant because we can't understand God, let us remember that whether we understand or not, we still are invited to share and live from that very energy that we speak of as divine. My mind, the life that is within me, my heart, my awareness, those are not separate from God. But to join more deeply with what the true God is doing, that's both our gift and our responsibility. And may we listen, and may we walk in step with that presence. And when we are asked to change, may we have the grace to let that change happen. Amen.